Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 431 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. This has been Squeegee Week in Baltimore, with lots of reporting, commentary, and reader feedback on the squeegee kids, that is, the boys and young men who try to wash car windshields for tips at busy intersections in the city. The squeegees have generated a load of complaints over the last several months, leading the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore to hire additional security guards to keep peace and order between drivers and the windshield washers. Some people think the police should just remove the squeegees from the streets altogether, though that is a fraught suggestion, given that the Baltimore police are operating under a consent decree with the U.S. Justice Department to resolve complaints about civil rights violations. Others don't see what the big deal is and think the problems have been overblown by motorists who just don't want to see the squeegees in the street. Some reflections on all of this with Sherry Parks today. She's Roughly Speaking's commentator on American life and culture. I'll speak with Sherry about the aesthetic objection to squeegees, that is, the complaint that they're an eyesore, beggars with spray bottles who make Baltimore look, in the words of some Sun readers, like a third-world city. Sherry and I share some thoughts through the windshield, so to speak, about what we think about when we think about squeegee kids and panhandlers on the streets of Baltimore. We start the show with my colleague from the Sun newsroom, reporter Yvonne Wenger. Yvonne spent some time speaking with squeegee teams this past week and with a community organizer who's seeking funds from the city or a foundation to move some of the squeegee guys into steady, safer employment.
I think one of the most interesting things about being a reporter is all of the places and people that you get to talk to. And so the afternoon, Carl Ferran, the photographer, and I went out and talked to some of the kids who were squeegeeing, and I learned so much. And I just, I wish everybody would have the opportunity, and I guess you would if you rolled your window down and just tried to talk to them, because they have a lot of interesting things to say, and they have a lot of important things to say that we should all be paying attention to. So this one young man in particular has left a big impression on me. His name is Rambo, and that's his nickname. He didn't want to give his full name because he admitted to the fact that he was selling drugs before he decided to give that up to wash windows. He said his younger brother came home with a handful full of cash, and he said, "Where did you get all that money?" And the brother said that he was out washing windows, that some people in the neighborhood had helped train him how to do that. And so Rambo decided that he was going to stop selling drugs. He had a desire to be living, less illegally. And so he took on window washing, and he is making money to try to pay rent. A couple of his friends that we were talking to were saying that they're taking a lot of abuse from drivers. And so it's a little bit of wondering what comes first. Is it the anger from the drivers, or is it the anger from the kids? They say that some drivers will come by and show them a gun, like to intimidate them. They said that they have all had their feet run over. Rambo actually hadn't had his feet run over, but all the kids said that that's like, you know, your introduction to window washing is getting swollen feet and toes and broken bones in your feet. And Rambo says that he'd been knocked to the ground, like, by cars that just drive away. And so these boys, there's a lot of fear among them, you know, despite maybe a tough exterior. These boys said that it's really scary out there. And, you know, there's a lot of people talking about the hearts that they're leaving. Rambo's friend, Sean, told me that he will often leave a heart on somebody's windshield, and that is him trying to convey well wishes for the day.
It's a heart made with the squeegee or with a finger?
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I didn't ask him to...
They actually mark up the window in some way, yeah, with a heart.
Yes. He says he does that when somebody doesn't have any money and they like politely pass on the service. And so he'll leave a heart. And he said it's him trying to say, have a blessed day. That's his words.
Let me ask you this. Because, you know, I got a lot of mail on this on my column on Sunday from people saying I've been spat on by squeegee kids, or they pounded my car. They pounded my father's car, and he's never coming back to Baltimore because of this. They intimidate people. They're too aggressive. Did you ask the guys about that?
These guys said, in fact, we featured a quote from Rambo prominently, and his philosophy on that was, he doesn't know what kind of day you've had. You don't know what kind of day he's had. And he says that his philosophy is, it's not okay for him to take his anger out on you, and it's not okay for you to take your anger out on him. But certainly experiences from lots of drivers would say that that the kids are breaking windshields or, you know, otherwise destructing property. Kirby Fowler at Downtown Partnership told me that some of their employees and residents who they're interacting with say that some drivers are getting like the washer fluid sprayed in their mouth. A driver told me that the kids are, by her perception, working like a game of distraction to try to get to valuables that she has like on her passenger seat. Another really insightful thing from the reporting was a conversation I had with this criminal justice professor, Peter Moskis, from the John Jay Criminal Justice College in New York, a former Baltimore City police officer. And he said that by the police department's own admission, that there have been some instances they are investigating of kids breaking windows or damaging vehicles, that is like asking motorists in the city to roll the dice as they're driving down. The police saying, we know, you know, not all these kids are bad, but there are bad apples or bad actors among them. And so, you know, he, to his point, it's rolling the dice as the drivers make their way through the city.
Point is that you might run into a bad actor,
yes,
but you might run into a good kid. Yes. This sort of sums up the dilemma in some ways, doesn't it? Because we hear from one side that this is all bad, and we hear from the other side that it's been sort of benign. It's part of city life. I deal with these kids. I give them some money. I've never had any problems. I hear both sides of it. And by the way, speaking of the police, is it illegal to walk into the street and wash somebody's windshield?
It is illegal to impede traffic. And Peter Moskis is saying that the police, like they did in New York City in the 90s, they have a lot of enforcement tools at their disposal, enforcing jaywalking or littering or any assortment of other offenses. But there are a couple of things that are really complicating the enforcement, and one of them is the consent decree and the work that the police department has to do to respect constitutional rights. And then the other is a Fourth Circuit decision that came out of a local Virginia lawsuit that had to do with a blanket ban that this Virginia town put on panhandling at intersections. Of course, you know the Fourth Circuit governs Maryland. This decision says that some panhandling activity is free speech. So unless the jurisdiction wants to go around proving from intersection to intersection that one is, you know, dangerous, they have to worry about some free speech protections that are in place. I'm not a lawyer, but what's been explained to me is that there is some interpretation about the squeegee activity. Is it free speech in the same vein as panhandling, or is it commercial speech because they're offering a service? And so it's not clear cut in that regard.
It's not per se in Baltimore City against the law to step into the street and wash somebody's windshield.
It's illegal, as far as I understand it, to impede the flow of traffic, and I don't know exactly how that's interpreted.
Has the Downtown Partnership deployed their security guards yet?
No, they are in the process of finalizing the terms of a contract with a security company, and then the security guards that work for that company will go through downtown partnership training, the same as the downtown partnership hospitality guards do. And so they don't have a date, but it's not going to be this week, and it's probably unlikely that it'd be next week.
But it's going to be.
Yeah, the plan is still to put those security guards on the corner. And the Downtown Partnership is emphasizing to me that they are not looking in any way, shape, or form for these guards to be performing any sort of police activities. And they want to make that clear to the people who are hired that they're there to just help keep a good environment for everybody that's there and monitor the activities. But I know there's a great amount of concern among some about how this will shake out. Do you know what? I have to wonder, is the weather going to be the thing that tables this issue for the year?
Could be. You know, if we run into some heavy winter up ahead and we return to this subject in the spring, maybe. Windshields get pretty dirty in the wintertime.
Oh, my God, that's so true. Yeah. Oh, God, all that salt.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say there is a man named Terrell Williams, who is a co-director of Turnaround Tuesday for Build. Really interesting guy. He kind of takes a preacher's approach to unemployment counseling. And he wants to create Turnaround Tuesday Junior for the Squeegee Kids. And he is in pursuit and has been for a couple of years for money for some community building activities that would start with an intense listening campaign for these young men. What do they want? Because, you know, over the years, the city's tried a lot of solutions for the Squeegee Kid dilemma. And so far in 2018, we haven't figured out a way to deal with it. And so he thinks he's got an idea that's going to work. He applied to the youth fund and didn't get the money, and he is continuing to knock on as many doors as possible and try to raise some cash.
Yvonne, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Yvonne Wenger is a Sun reporter. You can find her stories about Rambo and the other squeegee guys in the notes with this podcast. A short break for a word from our new sponsor. When we get back, a conversation with culture commentator Sherry Parks about the squeegees, panhandlers, and how we interact with them.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
The biblical phrase, through a glass darkly, has been used widely in popular culture as the title of books, plays, poetry, and at least one movie. It means having a blurred or limited view of reality. The phrase can be applied to the recent public discourse over Baltimore's squeegee dilemma. Some of the squeegee kids see their prospective customers as rude, even hostile. Some drivers complain that they've been abused and harassed by the kids, and still others have an aesthetic criticism. They see squeegee crews and panhandlers as public nuisances, reflecting badly on Baltimore and making it seem like a, quote, third world city. Sherry Park started a new job this past summer. She's now vice president at the Maryland Institute College of Art, with an office in MICA's main building, the historic marble edifice at 1300 West Mount Royal Avenue. That's where we had a talk this week about what we see as we drive through the city of Baltimore. You know, we sit at traffic lights and we see men, sometimes women, who look very disheveled, very worn down, holding up a broken old cardboard sign that says something like, God bless, please help, disabled veteran, homeless, please help. And then you get to another intersection and there might be young men, usually African-American men, with long-handled squeegees and spray bottles. And some people have described this as like trying to get through various tolls to get to a destination in Baltimore City. And the one phrase that I've heard in the mail we received since the squeegee stories ran over the weekend and Tuesday was third world country. This looks like a third world country. When I drive into Baltimore, I think I'm arriving in a third world city because of all these beggars, all these kids with their squeegees. So I was been struck by that and thinking about this a lot this week. And I wondered what your thoughts about that. What are your thoughts when you're sitting at a traffic light on your way to your new job at Mica?
So, I mean, as you point out, I see a lot more of them now because I drive into the city.
Yeah, that's right. Your route before was to College Park. Now you're coming into Baltimore.
Right. So my first thought is that they're very entrepreneurial, mostly young people, and that there should be another way to reframe that entrepreneurial spirit, because they're out there in different kinds of weather, even when it doesn't make sense to clean your windshield because it's raining. And that there has to be another way, because the refusal rate is huge, and yet they persist. So that's actually my first thought. Also the idea of people who are presumably homeless begging. I had a student, a former student, who's now in grad school studying home insecurity because he was home insecure. And he changed my thinking about people who ask for money on the street, because he saw them as the affluent homeless because they had, in his mind, given up their dignity to beg, but that they had more money than other homeless people. And so if you think about it in terms of hierarchy, as he was, it's a little different.
I'd never even thought about that. That never occurred to me.
Well, yeah, right. And he thought, well, I could beg and have more money, but I don't want to do that, and so I suffer more.
I was sort of focusing on the aesthetic of it, that the criticism that I received in these letters, the comments from people who refer to it as a third world city, right, or a third world aura or something, that's sort of an aesthetic criticism to me. It's like, we shouldn't look like this. America is great again. If Baltimore wants to be a great city, it should look like San Francisco or New York or Boston, but we don't see a lot of panhandlers. We don't see a lot of, we don't see squeegee kids.
Well, I think part of that is the way the city handles people who are on the street. Baltimore has decided to have a more benign approach. There are cities, I mean, and New York went through this, where it is illegal and enforced, and sometimes fairly ruthlessly, to get people off the streets. It's interesting that you say it is aesthetic, because that's how it strikes me, too. They don't want to see them. If you're willing to stand on the street and do something like that, there is need. There's great need. And so they're not addressing the underlying reasons. They're addressing, I don't want this on my route to work, on my route to... And so it's not a human decision. I mean, you say aesthetic, which I think is really interesting. I think we have to go back, and you have it in your writing, the idea of a quote, third world country, which, as we know, isn't a term that's used in diplomatic circles anymore.
Let me just stop you there and ask about that. I remember using this term frequently, and then at the newspaper we stopped using it and went to the term developing country or low-income city or something like that, low-income nation. And why was that? We didn't want the prose, the term, the phrase to suggest hierarchy? What is that?
Well, I'm not sure if many people know that the U.S. was, in that parlance, was considered a second world country, because it's Eurocentric. Europe was the first, not in any geographic sense, but in world dominance. And then the new world, quote, U.S., North America, is the second. And I think that's one of the reasons it passed out of favor, because that made us second. And then third, there definitely is a hierarchy. And how do you overcome that? And the idea of raising the bar and helping countries develop in a way that is not necessarily to move up that hierarchy toward Europe, but in their own way.
What is the connotation of the phrase third world country in your mind?
Third rate.
Also, I associate it with people of color and high concentrations of poverty, lots of beggars, poor sewage system, poor health, poor all of it.
Now, the irony of that, and this is not what I think your readers are saying, is that in some ways the U.S. is becoming, I won't say third world, but looks more like those countries where you have a very small middle class, you have a very affluent elite, and you have many more people who are disadvantaged. With the shrinking middle class in the U.S., we are starting to look more like those countries.
And we don't like that. We don't want to think of it that way. We don't want to really face that reality. And also, it's your perspective, right? If you're driving a Lexus and you're coming from, I don't know, Howard County or Washington, D.C., and you got a client, you're going to take them to an Orioles game or maybe go to dinner, and you pass through this these toll collectors, as someone put it, you know, panhandlers and squeegee kids. Well, that sort of interrupts your flow, doesn't it? That's not what you want your client to see.
Well, and it makes some people feel bad. It makes other people feel good. I think I've talked to people who give money to panhandlers for themselves. I am a good person because I give away a little money every day. And that in and of itself is, again, not responding to need. It becomes about me.
It is so interesting because I would actually just love to be inside the minds of my fellow motorists when we're sitting at traffic lights. What are they thinking when they see that skinny woman or the disheveled man holding up a panhandler sign? Or as the squeegee kids approach, what are they thinking? I think some people are fearful. Some people wonder, like, what's the story here? Why is this person begging? Why do we still have all these poor people?
You know, why don't they go away, these poor people?
Well, I don't know. Like when I said before, I used the term aesthetic, and I made the reference to the guy who's bringing a client into town. It interrupts his flow. It's like his good PR. We want you to invest in Baltimore. Say it's a developer or something. But you've got to drive through this and see this, and I think it offends people. They think the city ought to do more for its own image by just removing the people we're talking about from the streets. I really think people think that.
And that word removal is scary because you mentioned San Francisco, which of course has Skid Row, but it's away. So, you know, they're taken to some other place, which has a much bigger and worse homeless problem than Baltimore. It's just that in Baltimore there, and I'm going to use the word tolerated, because according to the law, that's essentially what's happening, that they're on the main thoroughfares. And maybe they're not saying we should do something so that people don't have to do this, because it's not fun for anybody. They don't look like they're enjoying themselves, but they're trying to survive. And it's certainly been mentioned that if you think that sleeping on the streets is an okay way to live, there may be some other problems in your life. We know that a fairly high percentage have mental illness that has not been addressed. Some people can't stand the shelters for other reasons, and there are certainly people in the city who are working on that. But I think certainly that response that you're talking about is not empathetic, it is not compassionate. And it is related, I think, to the flight to the suburbs, where one would not have to see that. Although, I mean, I've seen people panhandling in the suburbs. I've seen people panhandling in some more affluent neighborhoods. They happen, the ones I've seen, to be white. And maybe that is not as difficult to see.
It's interesting you mentioned the suburbs, because I had this thought the other day. And this, again, is based on the feedback I get from readers of The Sun, people who read my column and write me letters, some very thoughtful, some very angry and terse. But I think what I sense sometimes is that people are just not familiar with city life, that they've grown up in the suburbs, their parents grew up in the suburbs. We're talking about three or four generations now in the sprawling suburbs around Baltimore, people whose great-grandparents might have lived in a row house in Highland Town, and now they don't know from that. They don't know what it's like to live like next door to somebody, attached to somebody, or try to find a place to park on a street that's full of people and row houses and kids, and to traverse through areas where there are very poor people and where there are beggars. These are the things that you see in cities. This is what makes cities a little bit gritty, right? People like to use that term. And some people will say, well, I like gritty, but not too much of it. Right. So anyway, I was thinking about this, that we have three or four generations now in suburbs and young people coming who want to live in the city and have this maybe expectation that things are going to be as simple as they were in this, simple as finding a place to park in the suburbs in a shopping center. You know, no, you got to know how to parallel park in Baltimore. That's just an example of what I mean.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you keep coming back to the aesthetic, because there is this sense of the urban pioneer. And, you know, that is so loaded, that the city is this place where you come and you have your young adventure. And the grit really doesn't speak to the texture of people's lives. The people who are coming in and saying that Baltimore is a third world country, our city, one, I think, have not traveled to any of the countries that they would describe as third world, because the level of despair and poverty is so much more apparent. And also, maybe they haven't been to many other cities, because Baltimore isn't unique in the challenges that it faces in that way. Maybe it's the city that they know best.
I must say, I've had my moments when I'm in the city, out to dinner maybe, out to have a good time, and you just don't want to be bothered with yet another person asking me for money. And I'm sure this is a human reaction that everybody has at some point. You get impatient with that. You say, why are you still here? Why are you bugging me? Why can't I just go out someplace and have a good time and not have to deal with that and think, and all the thoughts it brings, you know, like, are you mentally ill? You're homeless? Are you addicted to drugs? It makes me think of all these problems in our society. I understand how people get impatient with it, but it's part of life. It's part of the society that we live in. America has a lot of problems. Look at the opioid epidemic how visible the drug addicts are.
Well, the drug addicts are more visible now because the opioid epidemic has involved a new population that's more likely to be white, more likely to be a bit more affluent, and that's where the concern is. I keep coming back to that phrase of the poor will always be with us. But we have in cities, to some degree, I mean, certainly New York did this, of sweeping them away out of sight, not necessarily to raise their standard of living. And I think that really gets at it, that even if you're on your way to an event that maybe was fairly expensive to go to, any compassionate person is going to, and I felt guilt. And, you know, how dare I spend this much money on something when this could have fed a family for, you know, maybe a week.
But what I mean is, you don't want to have to entertain that thought when you're ready to spend $200 for dinner and a show or something, right? You don't want someone coming up and reminding you of what you're about to do.
Well, and I think that is a human reaction. I would love to be able to hand somebody something like a ticket that they could buy a meal with, or go to this place. And I know, like I said, I know there are people who are working on this, because that little transaction doesn't change anything. And you don't know where the money's going. And so it's just hard. So I think we need to rethink this transaction.
Some people are already doing that, and my mail reflects it. So when it comes to the squeegee kids, for instance, I've had mostly women who write to me to say, I've changed my route of travel because I want to avoid them. I can't stand this anymore. I felt harassed. I felt fearful. So I just changed my route of travel so I don't have to deal with them. But then there's some other women who wrote to me and said, well, I make sure I have some change. I make sure I have a couple of bucks because I know I'm going to see them. So I'm kind of prepared for this now.
You know, it's interesting who they skip, though. One of the things I learned a few years ago is that even if you don't give, for instance, homeless people money, they want to be acknowledged. They don't want you to look away. They want to. But I noticed that particularly they, and it's not just me, they'll skip black women.
Let me get that. You mean they won't ask black women for a handout?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And this is from your own experience and from your observations?
It's both, because I first noticed it with me, and then I started watching, and there's an element of white guilt, I think, that is imposed there. I mean, because I always speak, but then, you know, they acknowledge that, and then they keep walking.
So if the panhandler is white or black, does it matter what the race of the panhandler? I find this interesting.
I've noticed it most with other black people.
Won't ask a black woman for a handout.
That they've looked at you, they've acknowledged that you see them, and they keep going.
They don't ask. So what do you think that's about?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was an extreme example once where there was a black panhandler who was frightening people. He was going up to women. It happened that there were four cars, all women. I was the only black woman. And he was beating on their windows and screaming and yelling and cursing. And people were getting very hysterical and rolling down the window and throwing him money. And he got to me, and I rolled down my window, and I said, you really need to stop. You really need to stop. And he laughed, and he said, yeah, and then went to the next car.
Sometimes when you engage and talk to people, there was a man on the MTA bus just ranting and raving. I mean, he was mentally ill. But he was profane, and he was just screaming about stuff. And people around him were bothered, but they didn't know what to do. So I started shushing him with a smile. I said, shh, like that. And he responded to the shush, and he would smile at me, and then he'd be quiet for a while before he started ranting again. But at least I engaged him in some way. I wasn't scolding him. I was a gentle little shh, like that. Hey, no, keep it down, like that. And it kind of worked out. I mean, he quieted down for the rest of the bus ride, and I think there was an eruption just as I was getting off. But anyway, I find sometimes if you engage people, that's the story of Wendy LeGrant from my column in Wednesday's paper. She rolled down a window and started talking to one of these squeegee kids and ended up having a relationship with him. And he smiled a whole lot more after that. And those things can be very rewarding, the kindness of strangers.
Well, basically, we're saying a human transaction instead of one that's just based on getting a bit of money or giving a bit of money, that there are people behind those faces. And if we engage the human, and I'm not saying I always do this, I'm not always, you know, the person who jumps out of the car and stands there and talks to them, but I think we really need to think more about them and stop having an aesthetic reaction to them about whether or not they decorate our corners in ways that we don't want to see.
Or make assumptions based on race and gender. Young black man approaches your car, you don't want anyone touching your car, you especially don't want a young black man, so you put on this sort of hostile get away from me face, and then maybe he's not so nice, and then we end up with this controversy about and all these complaints about squeegee kids.
And the other thing I've learned is that sometimes people make assumptions about black people who are not poor, based on kind of the default position. You know, as you know, my daughter is an equestrian, so sometimes, particularly on weekends, I may show up looking, you know, like someone who might be homeless. I mean, you know, T-shirt, jeans, I might smell a little bit, because horses sometimes smell. And the difference in the reaction when she's with me and in her jodhpurs versus when I'm by myself is really interesting. Now I have the luxury to say, oh, this is interesting, because I can go home and clean up and, you know, be okay. But it's really interesting what the default position is for black people who look a certain way. So you might perceive more people than you're actually encountering.
What's the general advice? If someone were to say to you, okay, how should I handle squeegee kids when I get off the Jones Falls Expressway at Fayette Street? I encountered a couple of young men there. They look like brothers to me. And I decided, yeah, I'm going to let them wash my windshield. So I waved them over, and they were very happy to do it. They did not spray dirty fluid on my windshield, as some people allege has happened. It was nice and clean. And actually, the windshield actually looked better when they were done. I gave them a buck each. They were very pleased. I told them they ought to pick up the trash. I said to one of them, you know, this is your workstation. This should be cleaner than this. Why don't you pick up some of that trash? So anyway, I don't know. Do we have general advice for people? Everybody's different, you know?
Well, there are several things about that, and it was a conversation, not a transaction that happened. One, they waited for you to motion them over. So I think some people respond to, I've heard the word swarm, the idea that they're being approached in a way they don't want. So you signal, yes, I'm willing to have this transaction. And they did a good job, and you rolled down the window and had a bit of a conversation with them. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
She felt pretty good about it afterwards.
Right. On both sides, there's room to think about this transaction and to make it more human. But I really do think that people should do, I don't mean that they can be rude, but I do think people should figure out their own comfort level and interact. I think it's okay to say no thank you this time, as long as you do it politely. You get to do that. I think you get to, I mean, lots of people give them money and say, I don't want my windshield, right? Because sometimes they're not doing a great job. But I do think that at any moment, it's important to be polite and human.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
Sherry Parks is Vice President for Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and a critic on American life and culture. She joins us once a month on Roughly Speaking. Your thoughts on this subject and others are always welcome. Drop me an email at drodricks@baltsun.com. Please review Roughly Speaking on your podcast app if you get a chance. You can read more about the issues we discussed today at baltimoresun.com. I'm Dan Rodricks at the Baltimore Sun for producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes the writing collective Unruly Catholic Women Writers for a reading and discussion of their new anthology, Unruly Catholic Nuns, Sister Stories. Sister Stories explores the voices of current and former Catholic nuns, and by doing so, contributes to the global conversation about the role of women in the Catholic Church today. Sunday, October 28th at 5 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.